I am going to read some scientific abstracts with some of this didgeridoo sound behind. And these abstracts, the language in them is so concise and terse that they are effectively the scientific equivalent of poems. So I'll give their credits after I read them. Coherent dynamics of a flux qubit coupled to a harmonic oscillator. In the emerging field of quantum computation and quantum information, superconducting devices are promising candidates for the implementation of solid-state quantum bits, qubits. Single-qubit operations, direct coupling between two qubits, and the realization of a quantum gate have been reported. However, complex manipulation of entangled states, such as the coupling of a two-level system to a quantum harmonic oscillator, as demonstrated in ion atom trap experiments and cavity quantum electrodynamics, has yet to be achieved for superconducting devices. Here, we demonstrate entanglement between a superconducting flux qubit, a two-level system, and a superconducting quantum interference device, SQUID. The latter provides the measurement system for detecting the quantum states. It is also an effective inductance that, in parallel with an external shunt capacitance, acts as a harmonic oscillator. We achieve generation and control of the entangled state by performing microwave spectroscopy and detecting the resultant Rabi oscillations of the coupled system. This is an article by I. Chiorescu, P. Bertet, K. Semba, Y. Nakamura, C. Harmans, and J. Muij. And they are from the Quantum Transport Group at the Kavli Institute in Lorenzweg, Delft, the Netherlands, and from NTT Basic Research Laboratories in Atsugi, Japan, and NEC Fundamental Research Labs at Tsukuba, Ibaraki, Japan. And in the same vein, we have to report strong coupling of a single photon to a superconducting qubit using circuit quantum electrodynamics. The interaction of matter and light is one of the fundamental processes occurring in nature, and its most elementary form is realized when a single atom interacts with a single photon. Reaching this regime has been a major focus of research in atomic physics and quantum optics for several decades, and has generated the field of cavity quantum electrodynamics. Here we perform an experiment in which a superconducting two-level system, playing the role of an artificial atom, is coupled to an on-chip cavity consisting of a superconducting transmission line resonator. We show that the strong coupling regime can be attained in a solid-state system, and we experimentally observe the coherent interaction of a superconducting two-level system with a single microwave photon. The concept of circuit quantum electrodynamics opens many new possibilities for studying the strong interaction of light and matter. This system can also be exploited for quantum information processing and quantum communication, and may lead to new approaches for single photon generation and detection. And that is an abstract by A. Walraff, D. Schuster, A. Blaze, L. Frunzio, R. Huang, J. Major, S. Kumar, S. Gervin, and R. Sholkoff. And they are from Yale University, New Haven, Connecticut, and Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana. Here's another one. Consider these to be scientific poems. Generation of ultraviolet entangled photons in a semiconductor. Entanglement is one of the key features of quantum information and communications technology. The method has been used most frequently to generate highly entangled pairs of photons. Is parametric down conversion. The method that has been used to most frequently to generate highly entangled pairs of photons is parametric down conversion. Short wavelength entangled photons are desirable for generating further entanglement between 3 or 4 photons. But it is difficult to use parametric down conversion to generate suitably energetic entangled photon pairs. One method that is expected to be applicable for generation of such photons is resonant hyperparametric scattering. A pair of entangled photons is generated in a semiconductor via an electronically resonant third-order nonlinear optical process. Mind you, a third-order nonlinear optical process. And the semiconductor-based sources of entangled photons would also be advantageous for practical quantum technologies. But attempts to generate entangled photons in semiconductors have not yet been successful. Here we report experimental evidence for the generation of ultraviolet entangled photon pairs by means of bi-exciton resonant hyperparametric scattering in a single crystal of the semiconductor copper chloride. We anticipate that our results will open the way to the generation of entangled photons by current injection analogous to current-driven single photon sources. So, dear friends, there is an entangled photon in your future. Yes. Yes. And here we have some entangled phonons. A didgeridoo phonons. And one in D. That's this one. And this one here, which is B flat. And so here is our acoustic entanglement as opposed to photonic entanglement, but we're entangled nonetheless, my dear friends. Oh yes, we are entangled. Yes, we're all part of the WGDR community. WGDR Plainfield, Vermont. And the rest of the world via the World Wide Web and on radioforall.net, I believe. Yes. Spanning the chasm, bridging the schism, with a healthy spasm of skepticism. And yes, dear friends, here is someone I love to read, because he's one of these... Can you imagine such a creature? A lucid physicist. A lucid physicist. And I have now switched journals. I am sitting in Physics Today. Physics Today from the American Institute of Physics. And this is its October issue, Physics Today, page 11. Whence the force of F equals MA? Does that sound familiar? F equals MA? Yes, sir. Whence the force of F equals MA? 1. Culture shock. This is an article by Frank Wilczek. And Frank Wilczek is the Hermann Feschbach Professor of Physics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And he used to be at the... Einstein's old institute in Princeton, and MIT stole him away, and he's a very clear writer, so I read his material every now and then. And, you know, perhaps one of these days I might have the audacity to phone him up and either ask him to an interview via phone or in person. He looks like a balding long hair, like so many of us up here. When I was a student, the subject that gave me the most trouble was classical mechanics. And let me pause for one second and say to all of you new age types, who maybe having physics shoved it down your ear is not your usual fare, that this article here actually speaks to the essential parts of energy and force and comes out on the side of you who believe that energy is what is important, not force. Okay? So, just to relate you immediately, our community here of... the energy seekers of the planet, should we say. This is physics, but this is physics that has something to do with what you think. When I was a student, the subject that gave me the most trouble was classical mechanics. That always struck me as peculiar, because I had no trouble learning more advanced subjects, which were supposed to be harder. Now, I think I figured it out. It was a case of culture shock. Coming from mathematics, I was expecting an algorithm. Instead, I encountered something quite different, a sort of culture, in fact. Let me explain. Problems with F equals MA. Newton's second law of motion F equals MA is the sound of classical mechanics. Like other souls, it is insubstantial. The right-hand side is the product of two terms with profound meaning. Acceleration is a purely kinematical concept defined in terms of space and time. Mass quite directly reflects basic measurable properties of bodies, weights, recoil velocities. The left-hand side, on the other hand, has no independent meaning. Yet clearly, Newton's second law is full of meaning by the highest standard. It proves itself useful in demanding situations. Splendid, unlikely looking bridges, like the Erasmus Bridge, known as the Swan of Rotterdam, do bear their loads. Spacecraft do reach Saturn. The paradox deepens when we consider force from the perspective of modern physics. In fact, the concept of force is conspicuously absent from our most advanced formulations of the basic laws. And I have a persistent caller. Let me say that the phone system is out of order, so I will drop into the background briefly to pick up that call. Dear friends, if you will bear with me. Friends, I'm afraid our phone system is not working, and that was Steve with a very pertinent comment, an extremely complex, advanced thought, which I can't quite recall. It had something to do with acceleration being abstract, but mass being a solid thing. But he said that in fact, to define mass, you need acceleration, and the other thing is, of course, that mass is not a solid thing, but mass is one part in a million. energy, and the rest open space. So, yes, Steve, thank you for calling in. I'm sorry we couldn't put you on the air, and I know I haven't done justice to the complicated relationships that you spoke of between acceleration and mass, but we shall continue, if you'll excuse me. The paradox deepens when we consider force from the perspective of modern physics. In fact, the concept of force is conspicuously absent from our most advanced formulations of the basic laws. It doesn't appear in Schrödinger's equation or in any reasonable formulation of quantum field theory or in the foundations of general relativity. Astute observers comment on this trend. Astute observers commented on this trend to eliminate force even before the emergences of relativity and quantum mechanics. In his 1895 Dynamics, the prominent physicist Peter Tate, who was a close friend and collaborator of Lord Kelvin and James Clerk Maxwell, wrote, and I quote, "In all methods and systems which involve the idea of force, there is a leaven of artificiality. There is no necessity for the introduction of the word force, nor of the sense-suggested ideas on which it was originally based." Close quotes. Particularly striking, since it is so characteristic and so over the top, is what Bertrand Russell had to say in his 1925 popularization of relativity for serious intellectuals, the ABC of relativity. And I quote from Bertrand Russell now, "If people were to learn to conceive the world in the new way, without the old notion of force, it would alter not only their physical imagination, but probably also their morals and politics. In the Newtonian theory of the solar system, the sun seems like a monarch whose behests the planets have to obey. In the Einsteinian world, there is more individualism and less government than in the Newtonian." Close quotes. The 14th chapter of Russell's book is entitled "The Abolition of Force." If F equals MA is formally empty, microscopically obscure, and maybe even morally suspect, what's the source of its undeniable power? Question mark. And this section is called "The Culture of Force." To track that source down, let's consider how the formula gets used. A popular class of problems specifies a force and asks about the motion, or vice versa. These problems look like physics, but they are exercises in differential equations and geometry, thinly disguised. To make contact with physical reality, we have to make assertions about the forces that actually occur in the world. All kinds of assumptions get snuck in, often tacitly. The zeroth law of motion, so basic to classical mechanics that Newton did not spell it out explicitly, is that mass is conserved. The mass of a body is supposed to be independent of its velocity and of any forces imposed on it. Also, total mass is neither created nor destroyed, but only redistributed when bodies interact. Nowadays, of course, we know that none of that is quite true. Newton's third law states that for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Also, we generally assume that forces do not depend on velocity. Neither of those assumptions is quite true either. For example, they fail for magnetic forces between charged particles. When most textbooks come to discuss angular momentum, they introduce a fourth law, that forces between bodies are directed along the line that connects them. It is an introduction in order to prove the conservation of angular momentum. But this fourth law isn't true at all for molecular forces. Other assumptions get introduced when we bring in forces of constraint and friction. I won't belabor the point further to anyone who reflects on it. It soon becomes clear that F equals MA by itself does not provide an algorithm for constructing the mechanics of the world. The equation is more like a common language in which different useful insights about the mechanics of the world can be expressed. It's a language. To put it another way, there is a whole culture involved in the interpretation of symbols. When we learn mechanics, we have to see lots of worked examples to grasp properly what forces really mean. It is not just a matter of building up skill by practice. Rather, we are imbibing a tacit culture of working assumptions. Failure to appreciate this is what got me into trouble. The historical development of mechanics reflected a similar learning process. Isaac Newton scored his greatest and most complete success in planetary astronomy when he discovered that a single force of quite a simple form dominates the story. His attempts to describe the mechanics of extended bodies and fluids in the second book of the Principia were path-breaking, but not definitive, and he hardly touched the more practical side of mechanics. Later, physicists and mathematicians, including, notably, Jean de Almbert, constraint and contact forces, in brackets, Charles Coulomb, friction, and Leonhard Euler, rigid, elastic, and fluid bodies, made fundamental contributions to what we now comprehend in the culture of force. Many of the insights embedded in the culture of force, as we've seen, aren't completely correct. Like so much about language, not completely correct. Moreover, what we now think are more correct versions of the laws of physics don't fit into its language easily at all, if at all. The situation begs for two probing questions. How can this culture continue to flourish? And why did it emerge in the first place? For the behavior of matter, we now have extremely complete and accurate laws that in principle cover the range of phenomena addressed in classical mechanics and, of course, much more. Quantum electrodynamics, QED, and quantum chromodynamics, QCD, provide the basic laws for building up material bodies and the non-gravitational forces between them, and general relativity gives us a magnificent account of gravity. Looking down from this exalted vantage point, we can get a clear perspective on the territory and boundaries of the culture of force. Compared to earlier ideas, the modern theory of matter, which really only emerged during the 20th century, is much more specific and prescriptive. To put it plainly, you have much less freedom in interpreting the symbols. The form equations of QED and QCD form a closed logical system. They inform you what bodies can be produced at the same time as they prescribe their behavior. They govern your measuring devices and you too, thereby defining what questions are well posed physically. And they provide answers to such questions, or at least algorithms to arrive at the answers. I am well aware that QED plus QCD is not a complete theory of nature, and that in practice we can't solve the equations very well. There's the truth. Paradoxically, there is much less interpretation, less culture involved in the foundations of modern physics than in earlier, less complete syntheses. The equations really do speak for themselves. They are algorithmic. By comparison to modern foundational physics, the culture of force is vaguely defined, limited in scope, and approximate. Nevertheless, it survives the competition and continues to flourish. For one overwhelmingly good reason, it is much easier to work with. We really do not want to be picking our way through a vast Hilbert space, regularizing and renormalizing ultraviolet divergences as we go. Then, analytically continuing Euclidean Green's functions defined by a limited procedure, working to discover nuclei that clothe themselves with electrons to make atoms that bind together to make solids, all to describe the collision of two billiard balls. That would be a lunacy, similar in spirit to, but worse than, trying to do computer graphics from scratch in machine code, without the benefit of an operating system. The analogy seems apt. Force is a flexible constraint, a flexible construct in a high-level language, which, by shielding us from irrelevant details, allows us to do elaborate applications relatively painlessly. Why is it possible to encapsulate the complicated, deep structure of matter? Why? The answer is that matter ordinarily relaxes to a stable internal state with high energetic or entropic barriers to excitation of all but a few degrees of freedom. We can focus our attention on those few effective degrees of freedom. The rest just supply the stage for the actors. While force itself does not appear to be the foundational equations, in the foundational equations of modern physics, energy and momentum certainly do, and force is very closely related to them. Please note, Steve. roughly speaking, it's the space derivative of the former and the time derivative of the latter, and F equals MA just states the consistency of those definitions. So, the concept of force is not quite so far removed from modern foundations as Tate and Russell insinuate. There's a rhyme. It may be gratuitous, but it is not bizarre. Without changing the content of classical mechanics, we can cast it in Lagrangian terms, wherein force no longer appears as a primary concept. But what's really a technicality? The deeper question remains. What aspects of fundamentals does the culture of force reflect? What approximations lead to it? Some kind of approximate, truncated description of the dynamics of matter is both desirable and feasible, because it is easier to use and focuses on the relevant. To explain the rough validity and origin of specific concepts and idealizations that constitute the culture of force, however, we must consider their detailed content. A proper answer, like the culture of force itself, must be both complicated and open-ended. The molecular explanation of friction is still very much a research topic. For example, I'll discuss some of the simpler aspects addressing the issues raised above in my next column, which I will read to you, dear friends. Before drawing some larger conclusions, here I conclude with some remarks on the psychological question for those of you out there who are interested in psychology. Why force was, and usually still is, introduced in the foundations of mechanics when, from a logical point of view, energy would serve at least equally well and arguably better. The fact that changes in momentum which correspond by definition to forces are visible, please note, Steve, the fact that changes in momentum which correspond by definition to forces are visible, whereas changes in energy often are not, is certainly a major factor. Another is that, as active participants in statistics, for example, when we hold up a weight, and as active participants in statics, not statistics, but statics, for example, when we hold up a weight, we definitely feel we are doing something, even though no mechanical work is performed. Force is an abstraction of this sensory experience of exertion. D'Alembert's substitute, the virtual work done in response to small displacements, is harder to relate to. Though, ironically, it is a sort of virtual work continually made real that explains our exertions. When we hold a weight steady, individual muscle fibers contract in response to feedback signals they get from spindles. The spindles sense small displacements. They must get compensated before they grow, which must get compensated before they grow, the displacements, I mean. Similar reasons may explain why Newton used force. A big part of the explanation for its continued use is no doubt intellectual inertia. That is an article by Frank Wilczek's from MIT. Mm-hmm. And, in the last 5 minutes... By the way, this is Peter the Poet. This is Spanning the Chasm. And I'm discussing the hydrodynamic functions of the shark's tail. The tail of most sharks has an elongated upper lobe that differs from the externally symmetrical tail structure common among bony fish. But the hydrodynamic purpose of this asymmetric tail shape is unclear. Here we quantify water flow patterns in the wakes of freely swimming dogfish sharks and find that they have a ring within a ring vortex structure in contrast to the single rings shed by symmetrical fish tails. The branched ring vortex is generated by the inclined angle of the tail's trailing edge and by its motion at an angle to the horizontal body axis. The vortex directs water backward and downward, which may increase the shark's vertical maneuverability. Oh yes, dear friends. We use digital particle imaging velocimetry, velocitometry to analyze the hydrodynamic function of the tail of four spiny dogfish, Squalus acanthias, mean body length 69 centimeters, swimming in a flow tank equipped with a vertical laser light sheet, by using high-speed videos, 250 frames a second, to obtain particle images. We were able to analyze the time-dependent features of wake flow from the tail. Six pairs of images were recorded throughout a tail beat for five tail beats from each of four individuals. Three centers of vorticity were detected. The smaller dorsal vortex ring includes centers 1 and 2 and is contained within a larger vortex ring which includes centers 1 and 3. Counter-rotating centers in the dorsal vortex ring produce jet A. A second jet B develops later as a result of the flow induced by the ventral tip vortex. Jets A and B are directed, on average, at minus 35 degrees to the free stream flow. Therefore, before combining to produce a single broad jet, initially little downstream flow is seen between same sign vorticity centers 2 and 3. Isn't that wonderful? Yes. They have a ring within a ring vortex structure, in contrast to single ring structure shed by symmetrical fish tails. And on that note, dear friend, this is Peter the Poet. We are attempting to achieve some kind of transfer of power here in the radio station. By the way, this is Peter, the poet, and when the phones are back, we'll have a discussion about this. This is Spanning the Chasm. We go Wednesday mornings at from 6 to 8, and now it seems that we are also in the time slot of 10:30 to 12:30 on Saturday. And so, dear friends, we'll discuss that later.